Hello and welcome. We're going to be talking about Windows 10 security inside of this module. So as we start to think about securing the operating system with Windows 10, we started to think about this from three different angles. Firstly, how do we secure identities? Secondly, how do we secure information? And thirdly, how do we secure the device itself against device-borne threats? And as we started to do that, we started to realize that you guys would need more context in order to be able to understand some of the changes, because not everybody has faced every single problem. So we started to think about what the kinds of attacks were that people were seeing out there every day, and you started been giving this kind of feedback to us for quite some time. The first kind of attack that we start to think back to is the kind of attacks that were really just done out of a malicious nature. They were doing it because it was kind of fun. It's kind of easy, actually, back in the day to be able to do this kind of thing. And I spent lots of time in my former life as an IT pro clearing these kind of issues up, dealing with outbreaks of things like Blaster and Sasa, and going around and manually clearing them off lots of machines. However, although they took up a lot of time, they didn't have a huge amount of financial impact. Today, though, we have different attack vectors which are starting to take up much more of our finances to keep them clear. This is kind of where we start to see new types of attacks like ransomware attacks coming into the market, where people are actually controlling who can have access to files and locking out the user of those files from their own data, and then obviously charging a ransom to get access. And then we have a third type of attack that we've started to see over the course of the past couple of years, and that is really the state-sponsored or kind of cyber terrorism type of attacks. These are very, very complex in nature. They have a lot of, because they're state-sponsored, they have a lot of money behind them, and that complexity means that they're very, very difficult to combat. They can be very widespread. So we have to have mechanisms inside the operating system that can help us with all of these things. Now, if you don't know how attacks tend to form, I'm going to just walk you through a very quick example of how some attacks actually happen to machines these days. We'll take the case of a nice, healthy computer. In the case of a healthy machine, how could something get onto the device itself? Well, quite often the user will just receive an email, and inside of the email there'll be something like a link to a malicious website. They'll go to the website expecting it to be a non-malicious website. They'll think that they're just going to buy some socks or a handbag or something that they won't have access to. And they're lured into entering, say, their credentials or downloading some kind of file. Then, once we have some malware that's then been placed onto the device, that's really the end of the attack for a while. It'll sit there, it'll lay dormant. The real point of this type of attack is actually to capture the credentials of the administrator when they go to fix whatever's happening on that machine that feels out of place to the user. And at that point, our IT administrator will come along, access the device, and the attacker manages to steal those privileges. They'll gain access to the tokens, for example, that the administrator is using. And that's where the start of this attack really takes place. They'll then use those credentials in order to be able to increase their privileges and start to traverse the network in order to access different file servers and different resources inside of the corporate network, always on the lookout for more credentials that have a higher level of access. This is essentially what is called a pass the hash or a pass the ticket attack, and you'll see these happen quite frequently now. It's not the only place where we need to secure the operating system, though. The data that's on the operating system also has to be secured. And frankly, most people don't really think about securing their data, and nor should they really have to. If you think about what happens in daily life, you make the most out of the information on your device by being able to share it with other people. That could be a business partner, it could be colleagues within your company. And lots of folks accidentally share it with the wrong person. It's very easy to go and look somebody's name up in your address book and actually find the wrong Dan. It's very tricky. How do you deal with those kind of problems? And we see that that happens in lots and lots of cases. Another very simple explanation is that people are actually just trying to take that information home to be able to work on it on a device that isn't their corporate device. They're genuinely trying to get their jobs done, and is it wrong that that's something that they want to be able to do? So with Windows 10, we've kind of addressed as many of these challenges as we possibly can. I'm going to just walk you through some of the challenges from Windows 7 and some of the ways that we've actually addressed these inside of Windows 10. First one is actually around passwords. We've all seen that identity theft has become a very real attack vector. So how are we able to start to make changes to that inside of Windows 10? Well, one of the things that you'll see throughout the course of the rest of this session is that we've done as much work as we can to make it so that passwords are no longer a requirement for gaining access to the tokens that you need on your device, and then using those tokens to access subsequent resources. We've also made it so that data can be protected when it's at rest on the device. Obviously, it's already protected by other mechanisms like SSL when it's in moving between devices. But when it's at rest, how do we protect it? Well, we've now made it using something called Enterprise Data Protection in Windows 10 that the files themselves are protected. So wherever they go, they're always going to have those protections with them. In terms of what we've done for threat resistance, well, we need to change the app trust model from a threat resistance point of view. If you think about a Windows 7 machine, we really trust every app that's running on that machine by default. So any code can run, and that's kind of okay. That's why we've seen so many different types of attack vectors come into play. With Windows 10 and a technology called Device Guard, we have the ability to more tightly control what will actually get executed on the machine. And then finally, we've also made it so that the device itself, from a hardware point of view, is actually attesting to the level of trust that it places inside of the software on the device. So it gives us a very holistic way of being able to increase the level of trust that we have in the platform as a whole. So let's drill into some of these in a little bit more detail, and we'll start off with secure identities. This really is the very first thing that the user does when they get onto the machine, so it's a great starting place. And if you think about identities today, we tend to secure them with a password, hopefully a long, complex password that's difficult to guess. But the reality is that long, complex passwords that are difficult to guess aren't something that we as human beings are really able to cope with. We are the weakest link. We'll tend to share them between different sites. We'll tend to write them down. We'll tend to do whatever we need to in order to be able to have fast access to the device or to the service. And here's a good example of how this typical password flow might work. In this case, our user wants to access his internet banking, he wants to access his social networking, he wants to access something obscure. How is he going to do that? Well, he's going to go and set a password. And if you're anything like me, you're going to set the same password for every single one of these sites. So what would I do if I put my bad guy hat on? Well, in that case, actually as the bad guy, I'm going to go and find what's the weakest possible site. Is it the site where I've just bought some socks? Is that the site where they have the weakest level of encryption? Possibly. Is it the site where actually they're storing the passwords in plain text inside their user database? Possibly. Could I then take that information and use it against the other sites that I know this user may be using? Almost definitely. Could I then leak that information out on the internet? Absolutely. So that's exactly what we're starting to see happen with all of these big password data breaches, where people's credentials are being leaked onto the internet. So how do we get into a situation where we can start to think about this from a device security point of view? Well, let's think about the device itself. The device is being issued a username and password, or the user is using a username and password issued from an enterprise IDP. They'll then use that on the device in order to access the environment. Well, as soon as the bad guy has access to that same username and password, they can access anything inside of that corporate environment. They have all they need at that point. So we have to introduce some additional authentication factors into this particular mix. We need to move into a world where we're using multiple authentication factors. Things like my face, my finger, the device that I have being registered in advance, those are all additional factors. Previously, we've used things like smart cards, and those are still completely valid as well. This is very similar to the kind of authentication that we're familiar with a PKI-based approach that we might see in on-premises environment today. So for example, here we might go off to our certificate authority, prove who we are, be issued back certificates, which we can then laterally use in order to present those certificates to an IDP, which will then authorize access to our network resources. That's a pretty familiar concept. That's how Kerberos works today. What about if we were able to extend this concept to all of those other resources that people are using in a more modern world, all of the resources that exist in SaaS applications that are based out on the internet? Well, that's exactly what we've built in Windows 10, a key-based approach. In this case, you go off to your identity provider, Azure Active Directory. We get hold of, we prove who we are for the first time. That may require us to do multiple factors of authentication with, say, our cell phone in order to receive a call or a text message. Once we've proved who we are, then we'll be issued with tokens which we can then subsequently use to access our resources that are out there on the internet. We can also then exchange those same tokens for additional tokens that will work with our on-prem resources. Of course, it wouldn't be a great solution unless we were using hardware in order to secure those keys. And that's actually what we do with a new technology called Microsoft Passport for Work. And indeed, Microsoft Passport if you're using this for consumer credentials, which it also works with. We place those credentials into a secure partition of the Trusted Platform module, and only the TPM is able to access those tokens. As a result, when we need to access the tokens, we've introduced something called Credential Guard. And Credential Guard will allow us to access the tokens in that container by asking the TPM to use those containerized tokens on our behalf. So in essence, the calling process on the PC never is actually given access to the tokens itself, only the hardware inside of the machine, which we actually trust. Access to that hardware is protected by a PIN or a biometric PIN. In the case of biometrics, that could be a fingerprint, my face, or my iris. All would be supported. They actually replace the use of the PIN to unlock that hardware container. They're very, very similar in that particular regard. So when we're starting to think about enterprise biometrics, it's a case of making sure that the false acceptance rate is incredibly high. Enterprise biometrics mean that actually a false acceptance rate of 1 in 100,000 is what we're aiming for. We also need to have technology in there for anti-spoofing. So for example, in the case of face recognition, to make it so that I can't hold up a photograph of myself or a picture on a cell phone in order to be able to sign in. We also need to make sure that that same framework can be leveraged throughout the operating system. So that's what we've done with the Windows Biometric Framework, and anybody can develop an application and have that run on Windows that leverages that particular way of signing in without having to provide a password. We've done a lot of testing to make sure that Windows Hello actually does meet all these requirements. We are past the 1 in 100,000 false acceptance rate, and we can actually make this even better by adding an additional gesture, simple shake of the head, to decrease the level of the false acceptance rate so that we're past that 1 in 100,000 level. We've done lots of testing against lots of different faces to make sure that this works really well, and the technology is incredibly difficult to spoof. So, how hard is this kind of stuff to set up? Sounds kind of sci-fi to be able to log into your PC just by being able to look at it. But it really is very simple to do. We just need an account inside of Azure Active Directory. And as soon as that is configured on the PC, that will automatically configure Microsoft Passport for Work on that device. Then we just need to enroll the biometrics to enable that user to unlock Microsoft Passport for Work. So it's a very, very simple setup of the entire solution. And one of those things that people sometimes think when they hear about the biometric side of this particular equation is, could I reverse engineer any of these biometrics? Is there anything here that's going to breach my privacy? Well, we don't actually store a picture of your thumbprint or a picture of your face. We store a little bit of information that helps us find the landmarks on your face. We never need to store anything which is reversible. And in fact, this is very similar to taking a hash of a file or of a string and making it a non-reversible hash. Very, very simple process and very, very similar, very familiar to anybody inside of security. Then, when somebody needs to access the device, we simply check whether or not it matches that hash template. And if all of those landmarks do match the hash template, then we unlock exactly the same way as if somebody was unlocking with a PIN. And then there are going to be cases where you need to do recovery. Perhaps you've tried to sign in with your face too many times and it's just not quite recognizing you for some reason. Maybe there's a really strong infrared source in the room. In that case, you just type your PIN in. One of the things that we've done with Microsoft Passport for Work is made sure that we always have that backup of the PIN that only the user knows for that device in order to be able to access their credentials. Okay, let's talk about information protection and how we're going to make it so that we can protect information when it's at rest on the device itself. Enterprise data protection has been built to make it as seamless as possible from the end user's point of view, but also to make it easy to administer as IT. You can select which applications and which locations on your network or in the cloud will form part of the environment which is protected by enterprise data protection. Then any data that comes from those areas or is created in those applications and saved to those locations will actually be protected by default. And the protections will follow the file wherever that file happens to go, meaning that only that user from that device will be able to decrypt those files in the future. So I'm just going to walk you through a couple of these scenarios. The first thing that we need to do is get to the position where this is all set up. And we do that by enrolling the device with mobile device management and pushing down policy to the device, which tells the Windows machine what applications and what locations are going to be considered to be protected by enterprise data protection. We also push down the keys that are required in order to be able to protect that data. Then in the case of data from known locations, as soon as that data moves to the device, it will become encrypted. We will encrypt it on the device. So that will be an additional layer of encryption on top of anything which is already built into the device, like BitLocker. The next scenario, when somebody creates some data. In this case, we have to have the user make a decision. Is this going to be for personal use or is it going to be for business use? If they choose business use, then we'll make sure that that data is encrypted. If they choose personal use, the data won't be encrypted. You can also make that decision on behalf of the user and say that specific applications will always encrypt data. And then another case, when data comes off of the device. Well, this is actually pretty simple. If it's personal data leaving the device, we won't do anything with that. But when we see that data which is EDP protected is leaving the device, we'll make sure that the encryption stays with the device and moves into whatever storage it's going to. So if you're saving to a thumb drive, the file will be encrypted on that thumb drive. However, you might now be thinking, what happens if I try and take that data and open it up on some third-party type of device, maybe iOS or Android? Well, what we're going to do in the future is make it so that it'll be possible to open those files on iOS and Android inside of the native apps that you'll find on those devices. So let's talk a little bit about threat resistance. Threat resistance is one of these topics which we've created a couple of different ways of being able to protect. We had a lot of information back about the types of attacks that are being conducted against Windows devices around the world. And as a result, our guys that analyze this information, run it through all of our machine learning, have been able to learn quite a lot. And one of the kind of key obvious things that we've learned is that actually, with everything being trusted by default, that causes us some fairly major problems. It means that any application can do basically what it likes to the machine without any administrator having control over it. And that really is a problem. If we look at other platforms, Windows Phone for example, we've always had a very trusted way of being able to run the apps there, and only specific applications have been allowed to run on the operating system. So that's kind of where we're starting to see enterprises want to move with Windows 10. So we've created two approaches that allow us to deal with this world of apps not being trusted by default. The first is something called Device Guard, a hardware attested way of understanding whether or not anything has been tampered with. The second option is also hardware attested, but it allows us to have more flexibility in the implementation. And that essentially is the approach of going down provable PC health and conditional access. So we're going to talk a little bit about both of those. Device Guard is actually built so that any Windows desktop can be locked down and only run specific applications which have been signed by Microsoft and are allowed by the IT department to run on that particular device. OEMs can also put the same controls in place. This actually means that the hardware inside of the machine will attest that the application hasn't been changed from what it expects it to be. And this therefore means that it's very difficult to actually inject code into any running application and have it execute. In fact, what's happening under the hood here with Device Guard is that we are looking at the code that executes prior to it executing and checking that the code integrity hasn't been violated. And that process runs inside of something called virtual secure mode, which is in essence a Hyper-V based partition on our Windows 10 device, which can only do one thing, look at what's happening inside of the operating system. There's no way that we know of for anything to be pushed inside of that Hyper-V partition apart from that we've built into the operating system. As a result, it means that the hardware is always able to attest as to whether an application is trustworthy. So we're just going to a very quick demo of how you can configure Device Guard, and you'll see exactly what the steps are to set that up. Okay, so let's have a look at the other approach, the more traditional approach to being able to do this, to make the PC prove its health. So, traditionally, any app's been able to run. If I've wanted access to a file server, to my email, to the wireless network, I've just been allowed access. Provable PC health actually moves us into a world where we aren't assuming that everything is allowed access. And this takes a number of different vectors being addressed in order to bring this all together. The first one being the device integrity policy. We have to make sure that the device itself has been booted into an operating system which is secure and reliable. The next thing that we need to do is make sure that in that post-boot environment, nothing changed that shouldn't have changed. Next, we need to make sure that the apps that are running on the device are okay, and that any malware has any anti-malware software, firewalls are turned on. Then we might have some conditions that allow us to check for anything which is an ongoing attack that's coming from an online source. And then finally, we have to make decisions around what we're going to allow access to. And we can use all of those previous factors in order to enable those decisions. So let's have a little bit of a think about how this works in practice. When you want to have access to resources that know about conditional access, they will then go off and check whether Azure Active Directory believes that your device is up to date. If not, you'll be referred back to your MDM, which may be Microsoft Intune, and you'll be forced to make sure that your PC is healthy. That check will just happen in the background, but we'll be checking all of those conditions that we touched upon in the previous slide. Having done that, we'll try and access the file server again, and the file server, the email, will know that our machine has actually passed those checks and we will then be allowed access. Anything that wouldn't have allowed us access to, the user will have had to remediate in the meantime. So if they don't have encryption turned on their device, for example, they'll have to encrypt the device before they're allowed access to the file servers. So that brings us to the end of the security module. There's a ton of extra resources here if you want to get access to them. And thank you very much for watching.